My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very glad to be here this evening. Very glad to be back in Jekyll Island, one of my favorite places in the world, I guess. It has many reasons to want to be here, but the reason I like to come is to see how they're screwing up the motel this year. I get off the plane in Jacksonville and I rent a car and I drive up here and I think, what's it going to be like? Will there be workmen underneath my room singing songs in Spanish again? Oh. And they did pretty well this year. The whole thing is down. But I want to thank Fred very much for inviting me. Fred has done a wonderful job here and he's done a good job of picking up for Bob Polk, who retired. I've had a fine time here. I want to welcome a lot of people that I've known for many years, some new people. I want to give a special welcome to some of my special associates, Pat and Samantha and David and Gordon and Lynn and Jim. And I want to... Say hello to my friends from Atlanta, the mother duck and her ducklings as they walk through the halls, adding a little zest to everything. But primarily, I'm glad that we're all here. It's been a wonderful weekend, I think. I very much enjoyed Ken last night. I've enjoyed hearing Ken talk a lot of times. He's weathered a lot of vicissitudes in his sobriety, and he maintains a good spirit, which is, what we're here about. And Chet this morning gave a... fine talk. It's kind of funny to hear lawyers talk and try to get your sympathy. I never, ever tell jokes from the podium, but I'm going to tell one tonight in Chet's honor. The devil appeared before this lawyer and said, I have a proposition for you. I'm going to arrange for you to win every case you try from now on. Difficult, easy. You're going to win them all. And you will become famous in your group. You'll become famous in your city. You'll become famous in your state. You'll become nationally famous. You'll make a lot of money. You'll be one of the leading lawyers in the country. And in exchange, all I want from you is your soul for eternity, your wife's soul for eternity, your children's souls for eternity, and your grandchildren's souls for eternity. The lawyer thought, okay, what's the catch? That's a terrible story. I'm sorry, take that off the table. And the young lady this morning who talked really was a... She had a very busy 18th year. She was in and out of about 15 hospitals and drunk and sober and crazed and made me tired. I don't know where she is tonight, but I want to say one thing. I want to say one thing to you. If you'll forgive me, I don't want to hurt your feelings. But a person like you really shouldn't drink. You just can't handle it, that's all. Lately, I've been thinking a little bit, and I've been talking a little bit about an experience I've had recently. The A&E Network is doing an investigative report on Alcoholics Anonymous. And the World Service Office called me and said that they wanted to ask them to interview me in Los Angeles, just as a member. And so I said, okay. And so they, 3 or 4 weeks ago, they came out to Los Angeles. And we have a meeting hall there called Ohio Street. And the whole south of it is kind of windows. So they set up this screening in the afternoon. And the sun came pouring through the window. And I sat there in a chair, so just a black outline. Because that's what it has to be for anonymity's purposes. And I'm a strong believer in anonymity. I've never had my anonymity broken at any time. And I've had... Because of my work, I'm on television a lot, and I'm on in the newspapers, and I've had an article about being Reader's Digest, all sorts of things, but there's never any break in my anonymity, and I really believe in it. But I must admit, as I sat there, and the camera was on me, I knew the sun was behind me, I just had an almost overpowering urge to just go. Just give him a little look, you know. But I didn't. And this producer started asking me questions, and they were questions that, unlike most questions, when people ask you about AA, they usually ask you innocuous questions, they ask you dumb questions. This guy asked very intelligent questions, and ones that were of interest, I thought, to the public. And I found out later he's married to an AA member. His wife is the granddaughter of Ernest Hemingway, and they live up in Idaho. So he's an interest in AA, but his first question to me was very unusual. He said, tell me this. Why is it that some alcoholics can stop drinking and others have to go to AA? Now stop and think about that. And that's really that kind of catches you aback. I was waiting, asking to say how many members you got or something. And that's an interesting question because it's absolutely true. There seem to be alcoholics who can stop drinking, and they don't need to go to AA, and most of us have heard about them and had them pointed out to us. Why can't you be like Uncle Leo? He used to drink, and he stopped drinking. He went to church. And I'll tell you something, that's certainly true. You know, when Bill Wilson wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a number of new people in their first year here tonight. This book is called Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sure you know. When he wrote this in 1938, he was 3 years sober. A lot of people think this book is kind of a miracle because it just is inexplicable, unexplainable. Now, miracles seem to be somehow cheapened because there are some people who just see miracles everywhere. We were talking about coming back from dinner tonight. And there was a lovely sunset. There's a miracle. It's not a miracle. It's a sunset. If you like miracles, come back tomorrow night. There's another one, you know. And miracles are things that are unexplainable. And why they think this is unexplainable, because this guy, 3 years sober, surrounded mostly by failure, most of those early A's all died drunk. The first 100, most of them died drunk. The stories in the first edition, most of them died drunk. Not because they didn't work, because they thought at that time they kind of thought that once you got recovered, you were all right. But he was surrounded by failure mostly. But he wrote a book that changed a lot of alcoholic lives. Now, if you're some of you new people tonight, Dorsey, some of the others might think, well, God, the guy sober 3 years. He should know enough to write a book by then. But by the time you get to be sober 3 years, you'll realize you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just kind of try to patronize people 3 years sober. Still going to meetings, Jimmy? Keep it up. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Because was that two sugars and one cream or two creams and one sugar? Never mind. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Not because they're bad people, but you just want to see how they're going to turn out. And this guy wrote this book, no background in philosophy, psychology, abnormal psychology, medicine, nothing. Surrounded by failure. And he wrote a book that's changed more alcoholic lives in the last 62 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. Now, that's a miracle. Now, in this book, he really didn't have advantages that we have now of surveys and investigations. Alcoholism has become kind of an interesting topic for a lot of people to get involved in. All he had, and he knew that there were people who somehow were different than he, and he didn't quite understand why. So from time to time throughout this book, he refers to alcoholics of our type. He never specifies the other types, what they might be, but alcoholics of our type. And of course, in the last 20 years or so, it's been very, a lot of research done. At this very moment, over at the Jekyll Island Club, there's a big gathering of professionals from all over the country discussing the inner workings of how to treat alcoholics. We just had one out at the Reagan Library last weekend in Los Angeles. They get together and discuss deep, weighty subjects, and they go home thinking heavenly thoughts. And I think over the years it's become quite obvious that at least superficially nobody knows why, but there are different things. There seems to be a type of alcoholic, and nobody knows why or how, but they drink alcoholically, and something threatens them psychologically. Either a family member leaves, or a death in the family, or they lose their job, or economic insecurity, or something, and they're just taken aback and say, "I quit!" And they quit. And they stay quit. Then there's another type of alcoholic who have become physiologically addicted to alcohol, which is not terribly uncommon. And these people must be medically withdrawn. And as they're withdrawn over a period of time, they're taught about the various difficulties that their lives have brought about, and the heartaches and the sadnesses. And when they finally get off, they say, "I've got it. You've saved my life. Thank you. I quit." And they don't drink anymore. In fact, there's a hospital, big hospital up in Seattle, that's been active in that for years. It's called Schick Shadell. They advertise, and they say something that to most of us sounds ridiculous, but it's absolutely correct. He said, "If you come to us, we will cure your alcoholism in 10 days plus 2 follow-up visits." And we think, isn't that stupid? But they got a whole list of names for whom it's worked. It has happened. That's another type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic that we're familiar with that is a bafflement to one and all. Because these are people who drink alcoholically and something dramatic happens, something that threatens their security, a death in the family, a loss of a job, departure, and they quit. But they always drink again. And these people go to hospitals and treatments and get off that alcohol, understand what it's doing to them, get off it. Thanks for saving my life. And they quit. And they always drink again. And these are the people, alcoholics of our type. The alcoholics who are a bafflement to their loved ones, to their families, to the medical profession, to psychologists, to clergymen, to jailers, to everybody. And all the stories we've heard this weekend, you hear it again and again. People who firmly nobody ever intended to wind up this way. And the problem is, we all get into a situation sooner or later, I guess, where we've quit, and then we start it again, and then they turn on it. How could you do this? You promised you wouldn't do this anymore, and you quit, and you got your family back, and now the kids are trying to do good again, and here you are drunk. And they think the patient knows the answer, and the patient doesn't know the answer either. And all he can say is, "Damn it, leave me alone. Just leave me alone, damn it!" And storm off and maybe get drunk again. And even wind up in that strange category that people like us wind up in, which is drinking to forget you're drinking. And it's hard. No one outside of rooms like this would ever understand that phenomenon, but everyone here understands it. You don't actually drink to forget you're drinking, but drinking causes a lot of problems, and drinking helps get rid of problems. So you drink to forget you're drinking. And everybody says, "That guy doesn't even care." And I think, they don't know that I care more than anybody. But that's the type of alcoholic. I tried to explain to this guy much shorter that there seems to be some alcoholics who quit one way or another. Then there's another type who can't seem to quit. These are the people who die from alcoholism. In America today, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, it's estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. And those people are alcoholics of our type. And it's kind of interesting because people outside of AA and some people in AA don't even understand the difference. Because most of us, I'm sure, have at one time or another had the illusion that we are one of the other two types. I will quit. When it gets bad enough, I'll quit. I promise I'll quit. And it's an interesting thing, that little squib in chapter 3, they talk about what we have in common. What do we all have in common? What does Dorsey have in common with Vernon back there, who's been sober for 43 years? Incidentally, I want to say, I'm glad you're here, Vernon, because I'll tell you, if you stay sober longer and longer, I'm always glad to see someone in the room longer than me. I don't want to be the oldest guy in the room. I want to have somebody up there ahead of me still cutting with a machete. I'm a little too tired for that. But what do they have in common? What do we all have in common? We're not much. We have not where we drank, not how we drank, not our background, not what happened to us, nothing. One of the little things we have in common is that people of our type have at one time or another inevitably, willfully, or inadvertently allowed ourselves to be driven to an obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it to the gates of insanity and death. Alcoholics of our type do. And some of them have been sober a long time and went back to drinking and did it. And we cannot realize that. That's an interesting thing. Why would you have an obsession that you can control drinking and enjoy it? In the first place, for people of our type, it's impossible. You are one or the other. If you can control it, you won't enjoy it. If you can enjoy it, you won't control it. But I believe I can do that. It's interesting that I remember describing to a newcomer once, for people like me, when you're young, it's kind of fun, you know. I usually get a little further into my story. Usually they don't start leaving until I talk about the Texas Nut House. But when I was young, it's like playing Russian roulette when you're a kid. And when you're a kid, you drink and click, ha, 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 click, ha, 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 boom, Jesus, watch that place, click, ha, ha. But as you get older, some malevolent spirit fills that gun. Boom, Jesus, boom, Jesus, I better, boom, click, about time, boom, you know, boom, just on and on. Endless. But alcoholics of our type are, why would we be in that position? Because we can't understand that why it is that stopping drinking doesn't make it better. It does for the others. Why doesn't it do it for us? And it goes all the way down to that same old little thing that I believe is in the stomach of every alcoholic that ever lived. But you don't understand. My case is different. And that's the flag. And you learn not to say it because people laugh at you. But you know it. And another question this old guy asked me. Interesting question. He said, why is it all these people go to AA and some of them, they all go to the same meeting. Some of them get drunk and some don't. Some stay sober and some don't. And we all know that's true. If we had this row full of this, what is it, the Virginia group? If we had this... I know that they're all sensitive and they're easy to hurt, so it's like shooting fish in a barrel is too easy. But if these were just all newcomers tonight, and we all went to the same meetings, in a few weeks, a couple of them would be gone. Another week, a few more weeks, another would be gone. Maybe a couple would be here to get a first birthday cake. Who can understand why? Hearing the same information, hearing from the same people, sometimes with the same sponsor. One of the ironies of AA, we're talking about it today, is that sometimes you go to meetings and you'll have somebody who just wins your heart. I'm so glad to be here. I've been sober 4 weeks, and I'm finding a new life, and I've got a, it's just a thing working out fine. I've got friends, and it's just, you think, yeah. Then next speaker, well, I had to come here, and I think it's, I'm tired of all this reading and crap, but I don't understand it. And I don't have to be here anyway. It's just nonsense. And you think, oh, man. And at the end of a year, the nice guy hasn't been heard from for 9 months, and that old sullen guy is getting a birthday cake. Who can understand that? It took me a long time to figure out at least my concept of that, is because he is trying to be honest, and the other guy is trying to be liked. Because it's very unlikely that people are new who have found a new life. But why do some people stay sober? I just think about my own life. Why did I slip in AA year after 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 the worst years of my life came after good people tried to help me in AA. I went to jail more often after I came to AA. I went to the state hospital. I went to Veterans Hospital, locked in a padded cell. And committed to a state insane asylum during a period when I was absolutely cold sober. And I knew all about AA. I was kind of a high bottom drunk for a while, and then a medium bottom drunk, and then I went back to low bottom drunk. And the last day I stood in the street corner in the cold rain, sick and desperate, if someone would ask me, your life depends on the right answer, Slim, are you an alcoholic? The answer I have to say, not really. I'll have to explain. It looks like I am because I smell like alcohol and I've lost everything and I've lost my home and lost my family and lost my car and lost my career and had my front teeth kicked out in the drunk tank in Phoenix 2 weeks ago. And I'll never see my wife and children again. Once upon a time, they called me a boy genius. I can't even get a job washing dishes. But I'm not really an alcoholic. And if this guy, somebody would have said to me, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. You look like one. I wouldn't have been able to do that. I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and explain the differences. So I probably would have had to do what people like me, frightened people, do when they get cornered. And that is, you take refuge behind bluster. And you say things like, oh, get out of my face, you son of a bitch. Leave me alone. Because you don't know the answer. I know the answer tonight. I've known it for a long time. I've seen it myself and many other people. The reason I knew I was an alcoholic is quite simple. Nothing mystical about it. There are people who like to make AA a mystical place. I don't think it's a mystical place. I don't think there's some sort of a spirit who goes through our room saying, you can stay sober, you two can't, you can, you three can't, I don't like you, you can't. That would make it terrible. I wouldn't be one of those chosen, I don't think. Because I wouldn't merit it. Some people would merit it. I wouldn't merit it. Because I'm a Norwegian Lutheran who broke all 10 commandments. And you can't get any lower than that. I used to say that. That's not true. After a sober few years, I re-examined my life, and I haven't broken all 10 commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. I said that once in West Hollywood in Los Angeles, and the guy in the back said, I did! But why did I think I was not? Because I'd been going to AA off and on. I was AA in San Francisco and Chicago and Milwaukee and Minneapolis and New York and Dallas and various El Paso places I'd lived and worked. And I didn't learn much about staying sober, obviously. But I learned what an alcoholic was. And I wasn't that. It was just that simple. Nothing mystical. I'm just not an alcoholic. So that kind of begs the question, well, what's an alcoholic? Well, everybody knows what an alcoholic is. Even the people over at the alcoholism seminar know what an alcoholic is. People driving by on the road out here coming from the Ramada, trying to find their way through their... I don't want to get into that. The guy that runs the tapes when I talk has to... Well, better shut that sandwich off then. Sam Topford Lee, you can do it, kid. If you mention Lee's name enough, you get a good recording. If you don't, every so often the tape goes, ooh. But everybody knows what an alcoholic is, generally speaking. In every generation, there are people who seem to drink too much. They don't seem to care very much what happens to them. They don't care. They have a tendency to get in trouble. Their lives get painful. Their emotions get out of whack. And they get driven to some place like AA. And the AAs sober them up and clean up their act. And then they feel better. Wouldn't you say that basically is the story of what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous? I don't know if you go to any speaker meetings. Where I live, we have a lot of speaker meetings. We're the only place in the world where we have so many. And I always tell people, you know, if you go to this meeting for the next year, you'll hear that same story 52 times. Different specifics, different people, different interpretations, but always the same thrust is there. I drank, and my life was painful, and I was full of fear and doubt and lost a lot of things. I came to AA and got sober and cleaned up my act, and now I'm feeling better. And some are spiritual and some are not. And some have lost a great deal and some have only lost their human spirit. Some of all, but the stories vary, but those elements are always there. And that's the one thing I could not overcome. I look back at those years that I was in and out of AA and before that too. I used to kind of try to pride myself and I maintain my integrity while the people around me are losing theirs. But I sold out. And I look back over this. It makes me cringe. I sold out to hold a job. I sold out my integrity to hold a lover. I sold out my integrity to hold a situation, to save a car from being repossessed. I sold out. I was an emotional prostitute. It's just ironic that the one little piece of integrity that stayed was the integrity that proved I wasn't an alcoholic. And that was really true. And I could talk like an alcoholic. Every time I went to AA, people like to hear me talk. Because I lost so much. I've had deaths and situations. Lost everything and traumatic things. I had 36 electric shock treatments in Texas because they're just trying to break me down. And just all sorts of things. And I could talk about that a lot. Because, oh, you're really good. But the one thing I could never overcome in my heart of hearts, what little integrity I had left. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I get sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get out of whack. And the longer I stay sober, the worse it gets. And I watch people around me talk about how happy, joyous, and free they become. And I can look back now, I couldn't identify at the time, but it always seemed to me, in retrospect, that there's a certain elation about getting sober. Something. Yeah, I'm going to get sober, and it's going to be a new life, and I swear to God it's going to be different in this town and this job. But eventually somebody puts an invisible spring in my gut, and every day it's just a little bit tighter. And every day it's just a little bit more irritable. And it isn't bad when you're a kid because it's kind of fun, you know, that you, you know, when you're young and you have some trouble drinking, you go on the wagon. I'm going on the wagon for a while. And you get a little tense, a little nervous, but it's always kind of, because when it gets bad enough, okay. But when you get older and you start getting in trouble, it really is brutal. Because now when you get sober, you have to start promising people. You got to promise your wife and children on the heads of your children. You got to promise your probation officer. You got to promise a judge. You got to promise an employer. You got to promise people who have the power to destroy you that you won't drink. And now you're sober. And the spring is there. And I know that my problem really isn't alcohol, but that's the only thing a couple of those will get rid of this damn spring. I never thought of it that way, but that's what it really was. I need a couple drinks, and then I won't drink anymore, but Jesus! And they won't let me do this. Guys I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn can have a couple beers, but I can't have a couple beers. I'm doing well. I'm a famous writer. I'm doing well, and I can't have a couple of drinks. I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to get rid of that spring, and I never got rid of it. I understood it. You know, that helps. I know why it got there, because I was repressed as a child, and I was hurt a lot. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. We were talking earlier this weekend about Norwegian Lutherans. Most of you aren't familiar. They don't come down here. But last June, I was talking in Norway. And I went up to see where my grandfather came from. And it reminded me what kind of a head I have to face every morning when I get up and open my eyes. My grandfather and all his relatives left, and a whole bunch of people left Norway in the 1880s, all came to America to get out of that damn climate. Then they all settled in North Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin. And they spent the next 60 years saying, Jesus, it's cold here too. You know. That's the kind of head I deal with every morning. Come on, shape up. Shut up in there. Shut up in there. You know. But the problem in my life was I discovered when I was 15 years old, restless, nervous, and I'd run away from home in Wisconsin early in the war, and I lied my age, and I was on a ship in the South Pacific before my mother didn't know I was in Superior, Wisconsin. And some guys got me to drink whiskey, and once I could drink it without throwing up, I discovered that's how it makes you feel better. Or using that same analogy a little bit further, I'd never thought of it at the time. That's how you get rid of the spring, a couple drinks. But psychoanalysis seemed to have an answer. But I did, and I found out why this came, many reasons. And I thought about that later. I thought, God, I feel so good. I understand it now. But then all of a sudden you realize, I understand it, but I still got it. You know, there's no use for it. Maybe late at night in a bar, when you're having to get in a beef with some guy, and he goes, hey, what the hell's wrong with you? Then you can tell him. I was repressed as a child. I read philosophy. Some I understood and some I didn't. One of the philosophers I recommend to you, a guy named Friedrich Nietzsche, very difficult, but I liked him because in one of his tomes, one of his protagonists said, why are you concerned about God? God is dead. Perhaps he once lived to set the orbs awhirl. But now look about you. Chaos everywhere except the natural law. God is dead. I remember reading that thinking, that's the best news I've had for a long time. Because if he isn't, I am screwed. I'll tell you. In fact, I've mentioned this before, but there's a very famous quotation on the wall of a theological seminary in Chicago. It says, God is dead. Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it, it says, Nietzsche's dead, signed God, 1906. You never want to read in a theological seminary anyway. But I liked reading him, and I discovered finally he died in the insane asylum. I thought, I must have missed something here. But it turned out it wasn't that bad. He died from syphilis. He wasn't crazy. He just liked a good time. But seriously speaking, I know that a couple drinks... I'll tell you this, and I would defend this with my life. Two martinis will make you feel better than a year of psychoanalysis. Always just boom, boom. You with anyone, Granny? I didn't know what to do. And I stood in that streetcar. I knew I was an alcoholic. And how could I overcome that? But when you promise someone you can't drink, then you're in trouble. I heard a guy talk once, and he explained that same, or I don't know if he said it in an inventory, I heard it somewhere. But I suddenly realized, that's me. I understood that. I never even understood it myself. But something I did again and again, and without even being aware of it. When I had promised someone I wouldn't drink, I sooner or later set up a beef with that person. My wife, employer, somebody. So I, without even being aware of it, I was doing it, saying, well, damn it, I stayed sober for you and this is the way you treat me? Oh, to hell with you. And take a drink. Never knowing that, it just subconsciously I set the whole thing up. Because I got to, because my problem, and then go to AA. They say, well, if you stop drinking, boy, you'll be all right. Yeah, well, not here, Slim. I went to my first meeting. I was sent to my first meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. I don't mean to denigrate you, because you are, I don't know if anybody ever told you this, you two folks who read tonight especially. You are the future leaders of AA. And I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. Well, anyway. Well, the girl who read thought that was funny. The boy who read didn't. I made another convert to the Crucify Him Club. Well, anyway, I went to AA, and it seemed to me the guy stopped drinking. I don't know what they said, but it seemed, I'm sure new people today hear the same thing. I stayed drunk around the clock, 25 years. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never felt so goddamn wonderful. You don't know what it is exactly, but there's something not clicking here. But I know that A is a great place for people who stop drinking. But what do you do when your problem isn't alcohol? Where do you go then? You go to psychiatrists. Today you go to antidepressants. I went to Thorazine and Valium. Not Valium, but Thorazine and other things. Took Spantown. I don't know if you ever heard of Spantown. It's for people who have dysfunctions. It's half Spanish Fly and half Milltown. It makes you sexy, but if you don't find anybody, you don't care. I'm sorry I said that too. Lee? But it's all very funny in retrospect. It wasn't funny then. And I stood in that street corner in the cold rain with my teeth kicked out, and I would have bet my life and did that I was not really an alcoholic based on years of being around Alcoholics Anonymous and good people helping me. Now, why would I stay sober now? That morning, I had to get off the street, so I walked to I found where there's an AA club, and I walked 72 blocks together just to get out of the rain. And I tried to look like a newcomer, which is you can sometimes get by with an AA if you look bad enough. And somehow I stayed sober. Now it's been 41 and a half years since I walked off Skid Row. And I've had no new therapies at all. In a sense, I knew as much about Alcoholics Anonymous in 1958 as I do now. I don't know anything more about it. This is quite a simple book. There are a lot of people who want to read interpretations in it. And what does this part mean? It means what it says. As my sponsor pointed out to me, just read the black parts for Christ's sake. Yeah. But I didn't know that at the time. You know, I'll tell you who authorities are in AA. Authorities are people who come from a long ways away. Whenever there's a convention, you have people come from long ways away, and they're authorities. Here we have authorities from California. In California, we have authorities from Florida, New York, whatever, they're far away. I happen to be a minor authority in Toronto. I'm big in Toronto with a certain little cult of neurotic AA members. And every year they have one day, and I go up there and talk on something like the steps or the traditions or the history or something. Then they have in the afternoon, they have a question and answer meeting. There's 100, always 100 people. And then I give a talk. And I love question and answer meetings because it turns out I have the facility to, while I can't think of the answer right away, to weave a tapestry of BS while I think of the answer. But that, when I think of the answer, it's just beautiful. And this couple, few years ago, Fred, what are you wandering about? Sell your tickets later, Christ. Well, there goes my expense money. That's the way I treat the people I like. So if anybody don't like, stay down. But a few years ago, and some woman in the back said, I have a question, Clancy. She said, if you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers. I thought, somebody ought to stand up and slap that bitch. I wouldn't say it because I'm a good AA member, but I... She said, just year after year we hear about all the years you slept and how long you've been sober. What was the difference? Just in a sentence or two, what was the difference? And I, there's no way to answer that in a sentence or two. And I explained that to her. I said, ma'am, that's much too complex a subject to explain in a sentence or two. It's a whole sentence. And I thought to myself, I'd like to, maybe I could talk to you afterwards. And go, here. You know. I didn't really think, well, I... But it threw off my rhythm. I didn't give any good answers after that. But that night I was taking a shower before the meeting, and I thought of an answer in one sentence. But it was a crappy answer. I wouldn't be able to say that because it's a crappy answer. If you're going to give answers to groups of alcoholics, they have to have a little panache. They have to have a little body. They have to have a little zip, you know. I'd like to have Dorsey leave here tonight and say things like, did you hear that, Clancy? He said, wet birds don't fly at night. And maybe another newcomer could say, yes, but after that, then he said, never mind if the horse is blind, keep loading the wagon. These answers mean nothing, but they give the newcomer hope. The answer I thought of that was so stupid was this. This is the first time that I ever allowed myself to do demeaning things that I thought were beneath my dignity and allow people to tell me what to do in AA. That's a crappy little reason. And yet I believe that is the turning spot in my life and the lives of all people like me. You don't intentionally even do it. But when you get, sometimes when you run out of gas inside, you have a tendency to just take on the coloration of the people around you. And you think, well, certainly if you just have a skid row and your teeth kicked out, everything gone. But that is the condition of being on skid row. Over the years, I've sponsored a lot of exotic people. Glad they put the flag on the moon and the guys won Emmy for the last 5 years for being the best director in Hollywood and millionaires and priests and psychiatrists and people also who can't hold a job shoveling snow. I mean, what do we all have in common? We weren't all thrown out of the midnight mission with our teeth kicked up. We got to a position in life where we had nothing left and we couldn't drink and we couldn't stay sober. And you're empty. And you take on the coloration. It seems to me like that's why they say in AA, if you're kind of new, you'll hear this again and again. Here's what that means. Stick with the winners. Okay? Who are the winners? Hard to tell. They don't identify themselves. They don't say, are there any winners present tonight? Yeah. I'll tell you who I believe the winners are. In my opinion, the winners are the people who've come to AA feeling just as bad and different as you or I ever did. You know, we like to sometimes get the feeling, these stories like, people are better than nut houses and Johnny Harrison and prisons and the people, all these things, the killers and all these dreadful things. You think, these are the real sad, tough stories. I remember when I was new, would hear a housewife get up and start to talk. Oh, Jesus. Come on, let's have more convicts. We don't have a housewife story. But as I've stayed around AA and listened to inventories and become a little more sophisticated, I've come to believe that, for example, the housewife stories are much worse than mine. Because they did something I couldn't do. They wanted a drink, and no matter how they felt or how it happened, they had to get up every morning and take care of children, for example, and prepare them and feed them and their husband and get them to work and then hopefully get a few drinks to sustain themselves, but yet get back in shape so at 5 o'clock you could greet everybody and try to make sure the neighbors didn't see you and try to look good as they not try to buy booze and hide it and have to get the children ready. No matter how you feel, you got to have that dinner ready. You got, no matter the husband's, you got to pretend you're all right and finally go to bed and just half crazed and know that tomorrow morning exactly the same. Day after day after day. And I couldn't do that. I'd run. I ran. If it ever got that bad with me, I ran. I tell you, I think people come here, you think, how bad did they feel? We all came here feeling as bad as we can feel. That's how bad you feel. And some of them stayed here and allowed themselves to be directed to take actions that didn't seem to make much sense. And went to a lot of these dumb meetings, maybe got a sponsor and did silly things in their desperation. And as they stayed here and took these actions, little by little their perceptions changed, which of course is the purpose of it all. To change my perceptions, all of a sudden life looks different. I don't seem to change, but the world around me slowly shapes up, little by little. People get a little less crappy day by day. And then you'll find these people staying in the meetings on a regular basis, trying to look for new people, come in to guide them into the same things. Those are the winners. You think the people have been here the sober the longest? Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not, Dorsey. I know people who've been sober a long time in AA, who used to be great AAs, but they've allowed themselves to atrophy into sour, bitter, nasty, negative people. And I just tell new people, stay away from them, because they got nothing to tell you except death. They'll also tell you to stay away from the losers. So who are the losers? Hard to tell sometimes. They don't wear badges. Sometimes they're fun people. And you won't often hear them say anything about it. But I'll tell you a phrase. If you hear someone tell you this, Dorsey, or anyone else new in the room, you stay away from that person no matter how cute he or she may be. When they just say little things like, oh, you don't have to do all that stuff. You don't have to do those things. They're your sponsor just pulling your chain. Come on. And I know that's lethal because I used to do that. And I sucked people out of AA and got them drunk again and again. And that's the one amend I could never make. I can't go back to the Logan Square group in Chicago and say, well, the two girls and the guy, I got to go downstairs to the Logan Square lounge at the coffee break and get drunk and stay there. I'm really sorry. Hope you got back. Hope you're alive. Or the people I took out of the San Francisco Alano Club in Chinatown on Sutter Street, or the people I got out of the Town North group in Dallas. Because when I got sick of being around AA, I want to find some people to go with me, have some fun. And I'd kill people. I suppose I'd kill some of those people. And so, Dorsey, you stay away from people who tell you you don't have to do these things, because they may survive, but you won't. That's a funny phenomenon here, too. You know, at the turn of the century in Long Island, there was a group of families that had a terrible outbreak of typhoid fever, and they couldn't understand why. Typhoid fever had been eliminated. There was no typhoid fever available. They checked the water. They checked everything. And they went through these families, and they only found one. Finally, they found one unifying characteristic. There was a woman named Mary Dugan, and she'd been the cook in each family. And it turned out they found her, and she had typhoid fever. But she was one of the very rare people who had typhoid fever, but it didn't affect her, but she gave it to everybody she touched. And she didn't know it. She felt so bad about this, she almost committed suicide. But that's where the term Typhoid Mary comes from. Don't be a Typhoid Mary, where you survive, but you kill people around you. And there are people here in AA who do that. And they can do what they want to, but Dorsey, you stay away from them. And everybody else, But that's why we come here, because these people will get you to take actions, to do the things that Ken talked about and Chet talked about. The young lady this morning talked about, and tomorrow morning Scott will talk about, the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which primarily at first is meetings and in getting involved. And it's like boot camp, learning when someone says drop, don't say why, because that by that time a shell may have you right in the head. You boom, okay. And do these things, and little by little take actions, because the purpose of it, it turns out, Dorsey, is not to get you more and more sober. When you're sober 30 days, I think it's safe to say you're as sober as you're ever going to get. The purpose here is that it turns out actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it takes a long time to discover this, but it's true. If I wouldn't, I wouldn't be here to tell you about it. The purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol does fast. To change my perception of the world around me. With alcohol, I can change my relationships immediately, but it'll kill me. So I tried to explain to this guy, the reason some people don't stay sober in AA is because they can't surrender. They cannot or will not surrender. And sometimes because they have such ridiculous interpretation of the steps, I did. I remember saying again and again, but I'm not really an alcoholic. And my sponsor had to point out to me, you don't have to say you're an alcoholic. All you have to admit in the first step was what it says. Have you had some trouble with alcohol? Yes. Is your life screwed up when you're not drinking? Yes. Congratulations. Now step two. You know, that's all it is. It's a simple program. Ken talked about that again and again last night. Dr. Bob talked about keeping it simple. Just in passing, I don't know why we're... Tell you how that came about. Because I know some of you haven't heard it. Most of us knew what he's talking about. You might not. In the mid-1950s, AA was coming apart. It had a wonderful surge in 1941 with this Saturday Evening Post article, and this book had been printed, and not more people were getting drunk than getting sober. And nobody could understand why. People were writing to Bill Wilson in Los Angeles. The people in Los Angeles hated the people in Akron. They thought they were too religious. They only talked to the people in New York. People in Chicago would not talk to people in New York, thought they were too phony, only talk to people in Akron. People all over fighting, arguing, people getting drunk, writing letters to Bill Wilson. What can we do? Our group is dying. And he, I don't know. And a guy in North Carolina wrote him a letter and said, Bill, we're going the way of the Washingtonians. And Bill Wilson had never heard of the Washingtonians, nor have you, many of you. So he looked him up. It turned out in the 1840s, there was a group of sober drunkards who got together, starting with six, and in 5 years they had over 100,000 sober people. Never before or since in history has any so many people got sober so quick, so many. And they were kind of predicated, much like AA, except to just stop and think. No telephones, no radios, no nothing. Every visit had to be one-to-one. You go down a riverboat. Get on a horse. There's no taking a car or a bus or a trip. And in 1845, these people were doing very well. Had famous speakers going out talking, getting articles in the paper about them. And something happened that seemed right, because it seems right in AA now to many people. And they said, if we can help drunkards, we should be able to help all sorts of people. We should be able to people who are not drunkards. Maybe people who are narcotics addicts, who are not drunkards, not heroin and cocaine today, but laudanum and opium. We should be able to help people who have religious problems. We should help stamp out the sale of alcohol. That'll help us. Big temperance movement, on and on. And they all got involved in all these projects, and by 1848, the movement was extinct, and with very few exceptions, they all died drunk. So extinct that Bill Wilson never heard of them. And he read about that, and he just had a terrible shock. My God, that's where we're going. And in a desperate effort to sit down and change, to save Alcoholics Anonymous, he sat down in 1945 and wrote the 12 traditions. Not the way we read tonight, they're very nice, but the long form. If you ever want to read them in the back of the book, in our home group in Los Angeles, we read the long form the second Wednesday of every month. We want the newcomers to know exactly what they're about. And what he's done, he's answered the problems the Washingtonians had and the AA had. That's why we have anonymity, because people aren't fighting over prestige. That's why we have group conscience. That's why we have our job is to help alcoholics. Our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, not to people who suffer, but to the alcoholic who still suffers. And he tried to introduce them, and people wouldn't accept him. We don't want any laws. We're here for spiritual reasons. So in the late 1940s, he rode all over the country in his motorcycle with his wife in a sidecar, and finally, in desperation, he and his co-founder, a man named Dr. Bob Smith, thought if we could just get them all together somewhere, they'll see that they're not to fight anymore, and we'll explain these traditions. So on July 4th weekend of 1950, for the first time in the history of the world, a large room was full of sober alcoholics in Cleveland, Ohio. And I have the tapes of that weekend. That is touching. The quality is bad, but by God, it's lovely. Six young guys have been chosen. They each take two traditions and get up and explain. These are not rules. We can't even enforce them. We're just trying to save our lives. Please accept them. And eventually they accepted them. And 1951, when they printed the book again, they put them in. But the highlight, one of the great highlights of that weekend is the thing what Ken described last night. Dr. Bob, this co-founder, had been sober 15 years. The first one doctor, Bill Wilson, got sober. They said, you probably wouldn't want to talk because he's dying of cancer. You probably wouldn't want to talk. He said, oh, no, I want to talk. Next to Bill, I've got this. I'm the best example at AA of 15 years. So on July 4th, his son and an AA member helped this tall, gaunt, dying man to the podium. And he started off by saying, I want to welcome you to Cleveland. I hope you go back and tell the boys and, to this effect. I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls at home that we're all here on the same path. And he said, I want to apologize for my health. It hasn't been very good lately. I've spent much of the last few months in bed, but I hope it'll get better. And also he said, I'm grateful that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. He said, but I wanted to talk to you. He said, I would indeed be remiss if I didn't call two or three things to your attention. And then he gave what to me has always been the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous, short and right down the row. He said, first, and his voice just picked up, he said, let us keep our program simple. Let us not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. Because when we're feeling good, we can be all very nice. But when we're challenged or tired or threatened, nasty, petty, character assassinations and rottenness, we have to try to watch that very carefully. And lastly, he said, let us never be too busy to help the man behind us, to give him a pat on the back when he needs it, to take him to a few meetings, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't helped us. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency. What a great little phrase. When we're too busy to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Then he said a few closing remarks and he sat down and shortly thereafter was dead. But that really is the message of AA and that's what it's about. That's why people don't stay sober here, because they don't understand it's a simple thing where we change our actions and do things, whether or not they make sense, because they've worked for countless people just like us. And the last thing the guy asked me, and he asked me some other questions, but the last thing I'm going to mention, I'm going to talk about not very long. He said, why is it that Alcoholics Anonymous, why are they so insistent that you have to be an alcoholic to be a member? Isn't it true that it's all one big disease, narcotics addiction, food addiction, gambling addiction, alcohol addiction? And I try to explain that. I have a pet phrase that describes that. I'm glad I had it right in the tip of my tongue. I said, let me explain one thing first of all. This concept that it's all one big disease began with the treatment center that only had one van. Second, Send them all to AA. Because it isn't all one disease. It's different things. It may be one disease, but it makes no difference. Why does AA require you to be an alcoholic? Why is it that in the world's history, of all the people who tried to help alcoholics, the only two therapies that have ever had any success are the two therapies that have dealt with one alcoholic talking to another one, the Washingtonians and AA? Why would that be? Why can't we help other people? And you have to get down to the root of the problem here. The problem is what? My case is different. And I have never suffered from shortage of advice. I don't bet you have either. I had more advice, for Christ's sake, by the time I was 21 years old, to last me for 3,000 years. But the one thing I always don't, and sure most of us don't, I know you mean well with your advice, but you don't understand the situation. You don't know how I feel. I've had countless people say, I know how you feel, Clancy. You said, no, you don't. Or you don't actually say it. You say, gee, thanks. But inside, you know, you don't know how I feel. That's the problem. Nobody seems to know how I feel. There's no shortage of good advice out there. The shortage is people don't understand me. Now, the odd thing about AA is this. You come here. And you stay around here and you hear people talk about secret feelings that you think you're the only one that ever had. They will talk about what drinking does to overcome them. You'll think, my God, that happened to me. Little by little, you stay here long enough and one day some old fool will come over to you and say, I know how you feel. And you think, my God, he does know how I feel. And then you can take advice from him because the door is open. And that's the great... Identification is the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing so revolutionary in this book that isn't in a lot of books. The point is that here I may come to believe someone understands how I feel and will listen to it and act on it and take actions that I think are stupid because somebody that I believe knows how I feel is telling me to do it. Without identification, it is all information. It's just more information. That's why members of AA who are also narcotics addicts formed Narcotics Anonymous so that narcotics addicts who were not alcoholics would have a place to go and establish identification. I knew those founders. That's why members of people who are cocaine addicts and AA members formed Cocaine Anonymous so that cocaine addicts who weren't alcoholics would have a place to go and identify. Same thing with OA. A woman in AA that I knew formed OA. In fact, as great an illustration as I know is why you have to be an alcoholic to be in AA is this. When I was about 2 years sober, I used to talk a lot, as much as I could. That was before I changed. Now I talk more than I could. But in some little meeting, I'd given a talk on obsessions. And this woman, just wonderful. So many of our new ladies in OA have these obsessions. Could you come over and talk in our OA meeting? And I weighed about 125 pounds. I wasn't really, you know, I'd no frontier. I said, sure, I will. So I know it must have been one of the very first months of OA. And there's this table and about eight fat ladies sitting around it. And I gave a little talk on obsessions. Very good, very helpful. I thought about it later. She didn't ask me to talk what you do about them. Just talk about them. Because I didn't know what to do about them, but I knew about them. And I got done, and I sat down there. And then they identified. And I couldn't, you know, at first I couldn't believe my ears. I mean, this woman here said, I had this cake for my husband, and I just took one little piece. And before I knew it, the whole cake was gone, and he came home, and he was so angry. I thought, Jesus. Take a piece and let it go with that, you goof. One over here said, she'd eaten two chickens, her chicken and her kids' chickens. I thought, you ought to see a doctor, Christ. No wonder you're so fat. Over here, a woman talked about she ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she went to the bathroom and put her finger down the throat and puked it up so she could eat some more. And I thought to myself, don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting. Jeez. I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done that a lot of time for drinking, be drunk in the afternoon. I don't want to be drunk in the afternoon. But I thought about that later. Why was it seem so stupid to me? Because it was just information. I didn't identify with it. Food didn't do that for me. That's why people can't identify with me on alcohol. I mean, who are not alcoholics. Alcohol doesn't do that for them. It is just information. You might waste your breath trying to explain to someone why you can't drink. You just have to say, I can't drink. Because they don't understand that anymore. This woman can explain to me why they ate the way they did. Why do you do that? Because identification is what makes the door open and allows information to become meaningful direction. I didn't talk quite that long, but I tried to explain to them. That's why we have identification, AA. That's why, you know, there are people today who say, well, the only requirement, the third tradition says the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. I got a desire to stop drinking. You can't keep me out. And what they didn't realize is that those traditions are just an abbreviation of, because the long form as they were written were a little too long to read all the time. And the third tradition in the long form says something entirely different. We want to help all who suffer from alcoholism. And when they abbreviated, they had no idea that some years later, non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. You can't get alcoholics in, and you can't keep the non-alcoholics out, for Christ's sake. Stay back, stay back. The reason we do this is not to be, in fact, there's a little pamphlet out called Problems Other Than Alcohol. Some of you use it. Bill Wilson wrote it. You might use it next time people give you a problem. Can a non-alcoholic be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? No. That's all. That's the answer. No. That's kind of clear. You know, no. Oh, what does that mean? Can a non-alcoholic attend open meetings? Yes. Can an alcoholic who also has other problems, addictions, be a member of AA? Yes, you can. It isn't we're trying to keep people out. But without identification, there's nothing here. So I tried to explain this to the guy, and he seemed to understand it. But I looked at my life, and I thought to myself, as I was going home that night, I said, boy, you know, it's nice that I was able to answer, at least I've been around sober long to answer those questions a little more tersely and succinctly than I did tonight. Because we would have had to have a series. And then next week we'll ask him another question. But we were talking about, I had a friend with me who had gone up there, and we were talking about being grateful. And I'll tell you something. I stumbled on something that night on the way home, after talking about all these things that happened to me and others around me. A gratitude that I don't suppose I've consciously thought about for 35 years. And yet, it's the number one gratitude in my life, and I just take it for granted. It's such a small thing. We were talking about the pool today. You know, we talk about our gratitudes and try to remember gratitudes. And all over the world, there are people like you and me who are spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, countless hours, subjugating themselves to all kinds of treatments in a vain attempt to get to something that I take for granted. And I suppose you do too. You know what it is? I have lost the obsession to drink. Never even think about it. But just think, all over the world, people would trade their lives almost to get rid of that obsession, and they can't. And we just take it for granted. I no longer have the obsession to drink alcohol. What that means, of course, is sobriety has been made, first of all, bearable, then tenable, and now preferable to drinking. But all of that is secondary. Just think, I don't have to drink. I can live in the world. When conflicts come, I can live with them. There are solutions in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've come, much to my surprise, to believe in a God that loves me. I thought I could never do that. But I heard enough people talk about God loving me that I respected, so I started to believe that maybe he did. And I believe he does. Loves me no more than you, no less than you. Loves us all the same. I have to remember that some mornings when I go to work in the morning, unlike you, most of you, when I get out of my car, I step over the bodies of men and women dying of alcoholism to get to my office. And I go home at night and I step over bodies of dying men and women to get to my car. Why does God love them and not me? Because somehow they cannot surrender to the fact that there's something here that will help them. And most people will not or cannot. And that's why it is incumbent upon you and me to hang together, to observe these steps, to remember these traditions, to listen to good speakers like we've had this weekend, to profit from it, to take it home and practice it. Because we're not here to become wonderful people. We are here primarily to remember that our job here is love and service. And we must try to remember to guard that erring member of the tongue and never be too busy to help that man or woman behind us and give them a pat on the back and take them to a few meetings. Remember that somehow here, Dorsey, someday we've all sat where you sat, Dorsey, and wondered what the hell this is all about. And hopefully 25, 40 years from now, you'll be sitting over here standing up. And they won't remember me or Vernon or anybody else. Most of us will be gone. But you'll remember that you're carrying a heritage that started with people just like you and me and will continue as long as people like you and me exist. There's no better place to be. I hope you stay here. Thank you.